Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, Fresno's 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness was supposed to be complete by the end of 2017. We'll hear what both homeless advocates and civic leaders have to say as they regroup amid rising homeless numbers. We'll also find out why cleaning up drinking water in Bakersfield is more complicated than it probably should be, thanks to over 25 different water systems that serve customers there. And we'll learn what message local farmers want to send to President Trump and the team representing the U.S. as it renegotiates the NAFTA trade deal with Mexico and Canada. Plus, you won't want to miss it, we go whitewater rafting on the Kern River in our lifestyle podcast Outdoorsy. That's all coming up later this hour. First, though, we begin today's show with a special report. For much of 2017, healthcare has dominated the headlines. But while access to insurance coverage remains a national debate, here in the San Joaquin Valley, getting to see a doctor isn't always easy, even for people who have coverage. It's not a new problem, and it's not unique to the Valley. But this area is especially hard hit by the lack of physicians. Today, reporter Carrie Klein launches a new series as part of a project with the USC Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism's California Health Journalism Fellowship. Over the next 4 weeks, we'll bring you stories about the problem and some potential solutions. Today, though, we begin by examining the stories of the people who are most affected by the doctor shortage and hear what they have to say about the problem.
Christina Bellotta is a flute teacher.
Yeah, that's good. Not so slow, though.
This gig in a little rehearsal room in Fresno State's music building is one of her two part-time jobs.
Yeah. And that's like really, really big.
Bellotta needs the flexibility of part-time work because a few years ago, she was diagnosed with bipolar 2 disorder, a variation of the mental illness that involves more depressive episodes than manic ones.
So I have like the chronic fatigue and the general feelings of darkness, and it's difficult to find energy sometimes to even get up, and that is depressing.
She's learned to manage her disease with therapy and medication, but she still has ups and downs and occasionally needs to cancel a lesson. Last year, though, she needed a lot more flexibility than she had anticipated. She was searching for a new psychiatrist. She's on Medi-Cal, and the only in-network option she could find who was accepting new patients couldn't fit her in right away. Her prescriptions ran out, and she was off her meds for weeks.
The light was really painful, and I was shaking a lot, and I just felt sick. And it was hard to keep going to work and keep teaching lessons and pay bills, pay attention to anything.
Even with her previous psychiatrist, Bellotta had been driving from Clovis to Kermit for her appointments, close to 30 miles each way. What Bellotta experienced was textbook doctor shortage. Offices closed to new patients, long wait times, and long driving distances. Some patients can't afford the transportation time or costs and end up instead in emergency rooms. All this in a region with an outsized need for medical care because of oppressive air pollution and ballooning rates of chronic disease like obesity and diabetes. Dr. Sanjay Srivatsa is an internist and cardiologist in Fresno who's troubled by patterns he's seeing in this physician-underserved area of California.
When you have so much burden of disease, it is nobody's fault, but there isn't enough people to take up the slack.
Physician scarcity is a growing national problem. By some estimates, the entire country could be short of at least 40,000 doctors by the year 2030. But when it comes specifically to primary care, California already trails national recommendations for doctors per capita. And according to Janet Kaufman, a professor of health policy at the Health Force Center at UC San Francisco, the problem is particularly pronounced here.
San Joaquin Valley has one of the lowest ratios of primary care physicians and of specialist physicians per population of any region in the state.
For every 100,000 residents, the federal government recommends a supply of 60 to 80 primary care physicians. Across the valley, we have an average of 39. The Bay Area, on the other hand, falls within that recommended zone with twice as many primary care physicians per capita as the Valley's most impacted counties.
It's sad. It's like many things. In the Bay Area, there's an abundance. And when we look at the heartland, you know, the fruit and vegetable basket of the nation, it's very sad and troubling.
So why such a disparity here? It's easy to think the region's poor reputation as a place to live might be scaring away new doctors, but the answer is much bigger, and it's an old problem. Dr. Michael Peterson is chief of medicine and associate dean of UCSF Fresno, a residency and fellowship program created about 40 years ago.
The rationale for placing us here in 1975 was this was a growing area of California, and it was a physician underserved region of California. So this is not a new problem.
And yet, despite decades of attention, the Valley still lacks doctor training. There's no medical school between UCLA and Stanford, and a federal law actually limits the number of graduate residents that hospitals can take on. There's also the matter of geography. Nationally, urban areas tend to have 33% more primary care physicians than rural ones.
If we look at the Central Valley and then you say, well, how many of those physicians are in Fresno or Clovis, and therefore not really benefiting the patient population in Porterville and Hanford, it's a significant number. So the smaller communities and the rural communities have the worst shortages.
Consider, too, the siloing of providers into insurance networks. A doctor you need may practice down the street from you, but she may not accept your insurance. That problem is particularly pronounced for patients on Medicaid, or Medi-Cal, as it's known in our state. California doctors who see Medi-Cal patients get paid less than in almost every other state in the country. That's one reason a quarter of Valley doctors don't accept Medi-Cal patients at all.
Those physicians that are choosing not to take Medi-Cal are not bad people. These are people that recognize that, you know, it's not a sustainable model for me to do that.
All of these forces, they're not limited to the Valley, but they converge here.
So the 50% of the population being Medi-Cal, the reimbursement rates that we deal with in California and specifically within the Central Valley all sort of couple together to make this the perfect storm.
Christina Bellotta blames Medi-Cal for a lot of her frustration. She thinks she wouldn't have been treated this way if she were paying for private insurance.
No one cares about you. You cost too much. You're too inconvenient. You don't contribute to enough society anyway for us to care about you. Like, that's what it feels like.
More than a year after her ordeal, she's settled into a new psychiatric routine with the help of Fresno County. It's an approach health officials are using to fill in gaps in care.
The doctor that I see, I talk to him through a computer screen, and he practices in Florida. And so, like, it's not perfect. There isn't a live person there that I can interact with.
But it works, for now. A sentiment begrudgingly echoed by many Valley residents. So why haven't we fixed this problem yet? And what else is being done about it? Answers to those questions in later stories, starting with the 20-year-old federal law that hamstrings our teaching hospitals. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
And if you've experienced the provider shortage in any way, please share it with us. As part of this series, we're collecting the experiences of listeners like you, which we'll incorporate into other projects in the series later this month. Leave us your story in a voicemail at 559-862-2714. That's 559-862-2714. This is Valley Edition. Nearly half of the entire U.S. homeless population lives in California. The questions of what to do with people living on the street and how to help them has long been a simmering problem for Fresno. Now it's rocketed back into the spotlight with a renewed city effort to end homelessness. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports the city is likely to miss a critical goal it set for itself a decade ago.
So we're doing a count. Right now we're trying to tally everyone.
Every year, hundreds of volunteers, homeless advocates, and city employees comb through Fresno looking for as many people as they can find to try and get an accurate count of how many people are living on the street. It's called a point-in-time survey, and organizer Doreen Ely with the Fresno Housing Authority says it's not perfect, but for counting the number of homeless people, it's fairly accurate.
Point in time's a very, very interesting way of counting homeless people, but they're not necessarily the best way because you're only doing it on one night at one particular point in time. So, for example, you could actually be a homeless individual, Jeff, but if you spent the night on your brother's couch on the night that we were doing the count, we wouldn't count you.
And it's growing increasingly clear that Fresno will not meet a goal it set 10 years ago of eliminating functional homelessness, which is someone homeless for 30 days or more. There are now close to 1,300 people living without shelter in the city. A new ordinance the city is considering has pushed the question of how to solve this decades-old problem once and for all. The Fresno City Council has given initial approval to an ordinance that would ban camping on public and private land in the city limits. It would let police confront people living in tents and offer them the option of going to jail or a homeless shelter, but they could not stay where they are. The bill's sponsor, District 2 Council Member Steve Brandau, says there are as many as 600 people living a camping lifestyle, who he claims have become more aggressive and belligerent with residents and businesses.
Right now, we have 600 people holding a city of 500,000 people hostage. That's what I'm responding to. That's who I want to help.
Police Chief Jerry Dyer endorsed the measure as another tool to disrupt this behavior and try and get homeless people off the streets. But there's a catch here. City officials freely admit they don't have enough temporary beds or other resources to take care of every homeless person. Sean Jenkins is the president of the Fresno Madera Continuum of Care, which oversees many homeless services and runs the point-in-time survey. He says they support the ban, but they still need more services.
So we have 600 beds out there. We're probably at a 98% capacity, so there's turnover in there. So those are already filled. So now on top of it, we have another 1,300 homeless.
He also says spreading the homeless around the city has created a perception that there are actually more homeless than there are because they're more visible. 10 years ago, the city submitted a plan to the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development on how it intends to reach functional zero homelessness. That deadline is this year.
Are we going to get there?
No, we're not. So we've worked really hard. We continue to work on it. But we fell short with having the resources to actually house everybody. So that's kind of where we're at this point.
But for the homeless advocates, the proposed camping ban is just another step in a long parade of indignities they say the city has inflicted on homeless residents.
Out there in the streets, what it looks like is people are trying to hinder them so much that they get upset and leave.
Desiree Martinez runs Homeless in Fresno, a homeless outreach and advocacy organization. Martinez herself spent nearly 2 years homeless after injuring her back and losing her job. Now she works to help other homeless people. She says the camping ban is just another sign that Fresno simply wants the homeless to go away, stretching all the way back to the city's destruction of homeless camps in 2006.
So you keep taking away stuff from people that don't have anything, then they're still stuck. You're digging that hole deeper and deeper and deeper. So there's no 15-foot ladder that's going to go down and get them. We can make them, but I don't think the city's willing to make them. Stop hindering them. Stop taking away the survival.
Martina says she does not see any coherent path forward from the city to address homelessness and get people off the streets, other than making life so uncomfortable they leave on their own. Short of that, she says there's no way the city will address the homeless problem. However, Sean Jenkins says the federal government has actually given the city high marks for the work it's done. He says it's unlikely they will pull any funding from the city as a result of not hitting their 10-year goal. However, at the same time, he says federal support to decrease homelessness has been stagnant for years. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. Bakersfield is known for many things, music, oil, and agriculture, but when it comes to water, what makes it unique is its infrastructure. Nearly 30 water systems serve customers in the Bakersfield area. When it comes to water contamination, that makes solving the problem really complicated. FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports on the complex situation in Bakersfield and what's being done to simplify it in the latest edition of our series, Contaminated.
From Keith Prickett's front yard, just east of Bakersfield, you can see the trees of where the official city begins. He's on the board of a tiny water system with less than 30 homes. It's called the Wilson Road Water System, and the water he's washing his dishes with is polluted with nitrates.
It doesn't taste funny, but, you know, because it's high in nitrates, we do not cook with it. We don't drink it, but we shower and use it for everything else.
Drinking nitrates is most harmful to infants. It restricts the flow of oxygen to the body and can lead to so-called blue baby syndrome or even death. Prickett's neighborhood discovered the problem 8 years ago. They've known about it for a long time, but the fix hasn't come yet because their district is too small and solving the problem is really expensive.
To do this, it's between $80,000 and $100,000 per household. We're actually considered low income. We're less than $49,545 per household.
As of now, he says they could have clean water in a couple years if a large water district nearby helps solve their problem by extending water lines to the community. They'll also need to dig a new well. Prickett's community isn't alone. One of the many things that makes Bakersfield unique is that there are over 25 water systems in this area. That makes it difficult to find long-term solutions for all these communities with contamination issues.
All the paperwork's done, everything's ready, they're just waiting to present it to the California Water Board again for approval. Every time we get what they say funded and it's going to go in front of the board, they say it'll be about 2 years. I've been working on it for 5 years now.
But why is it this way in Bakersfield? Art Cianello is a director of water services for the city. He says there are so many water systems here because as Bakersfield's grown, it's engulfed unincorporated communities and also allowed new developments to dig their own wells and govern their own water systems.
A lot of it had to do with history because being predominantly agricultural, it was common then that a group of homes would drill a well and maybe have a water storage tank and create a mutual water company to provide water.
Lots of these systems, including the two largest, are in the process of meeting a January cleanup deadline for a contaminant called 123 TCP. It's a component of a fumigant that was used heavily in agriculture to kill tiny worms that eat plants. It's invisible, and when consumed over a long period of time can cause cancer. The state will start regulating the chemical in January, and water companies will have to start testing for it every month. The largest water systems in the area are racing to fix the problem. Jeff Foltz is the assistant district manager for Cal Water Services in Bakersfield. They're in charge of 136 wells serving 70,000 connections. We're at one of the sites that already has a giant charcoal filter system that removes 123 TCP. He says it's like a giant Brita water filter.
It's a very similar thing to what's inside of your refrigerator filter. It's a 20 feet tall, big giant egg-looking vessels, but they're filled with this granular activated carbon. That media does the filtering of TCP.
Calwater also operates the city of Bakersfield's 61 wells that service another 40,000 connections. Together, 68 of the wells test above the state's future standard for 123 TCP. Calwater is paying out-of-pocket to build the cleanup sites, but the city may have to take out bonds to pay for them and may increase water rates. To pay for this, both are suing the companies that created the fumigants in hopes of a payout. Calwater Services Bakersfield District Manager Mike Mares says if they win the lawsuits, then they can use the money to reimburse themselves.
Hopefully, at some point, the litigation will be resolved and we can recover those costs at a zero impact to our customers. However, if there is a situation where we do need to recover funds to pay for this, that'll be brought up in a future rate case.
The larger systems can afford to clean up their water. Mara says the worst wells will be fixed by the first of the year, and the city says it'll cost around $55 million to clean up their 41 contaminated wells. But smaller water systems dealing with 123 TCP contamination are at a standstill. Many can't afford the millions it'll take to clean up their water. All the small districts dealing with 123 TCP contamination I spoke with refused to go on record because they're currently in litigation. Tricia Wathen oversees Bakersfield for the State Water Resources Control Board.
It's very different for the small ones that are disadvantaged, that have one source that they can't shut down, and they have to wait until either the litigation is settled to really pursue and install treatment.
Still, Wathen says Bakersfield is ahead of the game when it comes to fixing their problems with 123 TCP. But for small water systems, it may be years and years before they find a long-term solution. Wathen also says that the litigation, if successful, could actually solve some of the city's other water problems by further consolidating the city's dozens of water systems. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero in Bakersfield.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The first round of talks surrounding the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement concluded last Sunday. Representatives of Canada, the United States, and Mexico are discussing ways to modernize the pact that was first signed by President George H.W. Bush in 1992. Last fall, then-candidate Donald Trump made attacking the Free Trade Pact a centerpiece of his campaign, claiming it has destroyed the country's manufacturing base.
Okay. You go to New England, you go to Ohio, Pennsylvania, you go anywhere you want, Secretary Clinton, and you will see devastation where manufacturing is down 30, 40, sometimes 50%. NAFTA is the worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country.
While the impact of NAFTA on the U.S. manufacturing industry is a matter of considerable debate, one area that has benefited is agriculture. By removing tariffs to crops grown in the U.S., American farmers saw exports soar. The value of ag exports to Mexico and Canada has more than quadrupled from around $9 billion in 1993 to nearly $40 billion in 2015. So what do Valley farmers want to see in a revised NAFTA? We have Joel Nelson with California Citrus Mutual, who represents growers behind California's multi-billion dollar citrus industry, on the phone with us now. Joel, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how significant are the Mexican and Canadian markets for California citrus growers presently?
Canada is extremely significant. We love the Canadians because they love all of our fruit, and that's our largest export market. So our words to the administration once this effort commenced was, please do no harm. We'd hate to lose the opportunity for that export market. The Mexican market is not a big market for us. They produce a multitude of citrus down there in their own right. The economy is not as strong as that exists in Canada. And our costs are so heavy that we have to generate some significant revenue on a per pound basis. So that's not a major market for us. As the Mexican industry has become a little bit more efficient, they've been able to export, from their perspective, a little bit of fruit into the United States, into California. So then you get into the question of what type of protocols, what type of approaches are they using to ensure our industry is not susceptible to pest or disease issues. So those are the two differences relative to Mexico and Canada from our perspective.
How have you seen your industry change with regards to trade in, you know, the past two decades plus to trade deals overall? Has the export market become more significant, even looking beyond just North America?
Most definitely. The NAFTA agreement was a major impetus for us to expand our business into Canada. But then that was followed by an opportunity for the Korean Free Trade Agreement. And that was a very positive agreement for this industry. And our business has increased dramatically going into Korea. Since then, the marketers have been working hard to expand sales opportunities in China. And that market has grown. There's a lot of opportunity there. The Japanese market has been relatively flat, but we thought we were going to see an opportunity for increased exports through TPP as a tariff was going to come down. And that country has the largest tariff against California citrus of any nation in the world. So we were hopeful of that agreement achieving some objectives, but unfortunately that's been put on the back burner.
Now, it's received a lot less attention in the media, but that Korean agreement that you just mentioned is also up for renegotiation now. And President Trump has also talked about efforts to crack down on trade, to have a more protectionist stance overall with other countries. How much of a concern is that for your industry?
There's problems here, potentially. And again, we get back to that popular phrase, please do no harm. We have to remember that with any trade agreement, there's a multitude of business sectors that can be impacted or affected one way or another. And you think back to NAFTA 25 years ago, you really didn't have the electronic means, the cyberspace that we have today, and the ability of hackers and the ability to communicate in different modes. You didn't have the large financial base that is interacted with varied countries, Mexico being one. So it needed to be modernized. It needed to be upgraded. As it relates again to California citrus, it's the phytosanitary issues. We're extremely vulnerable here in California because of our temperate climate to pest and disease issues flourishing. And we've witnessed problems with our colleagues in the avocado industry that once imports were allowed to a greater degree into the United States, their farming practices changed. They had more invasive pests. Now, can we pinpoint an exact country and an exact pest that goes along with this? No, but it's not a coincidence that their farming costs have exploded because of invasive pests. We're sensitive to that. We don't want to see these costs go up. We don't want to see the potential damage occurring. So we're going to monitor that part of the conversation very closely.
So it's safe to say those are the types of changes that you would like to see when the president talks about modernizing a deal, at least for your industry?
That's most correct. We have asked that the language that was in the TPP specific to pest and disease issues just be cut out and moved over to NAFTA, quite frankly, because that was acceptable to, well, frankly, all of agriculture, to my knowledge, at least in the fruit and vegetable industry, it was acceptable. So we would hope that that language would be incorporated into the new NAFTA agreement.
Wouldn't it be feasible or advisable if there were some issue with pest and disease? Isn't that something that could be handled outside of a treaty, or are you really hamstrung by the agreements that are already in place?
You always need a treaty, whether it's conducted through a bilateral with Japan or Korea. Let's use Korea as an example. Annually, there's a review between the two countries as to how well each commodity sector is satisfying the words on paper specific to a protocol for export or imports. So the Department of Agriculture will be sitting down with their Korean counterparts this fall. Fortunately, the citrus issue is not a major area of concern, but there's still some challenges that they'd like to see us overcome, and so we'll be addressing those. Concurrently, there are countries such as South Africa that wish to have an expanded role in sending exports into the United States, of which our industry opposes because there's a significant threat of citrus black spot and some other diseases that can adversely affect our cultural practices and the quality of our products. So every year there's something that has to be renegotiated, has to be updated, upgraded, if you will. And when it comes to the NAFTA agreement, when we first negotiated that, the exports from Mexico were not considered a major area of concern because they just didn't produce the quality. Well, those farmers are doing a better job. If they want access to this market, they're going to have to make sure that they have the pest and disease issues under control and are adhering to a protocol.
If there were a crackdown on exports, on trade, a more protectionist stance, how much could the citrus industry stand to lose here in this area? How big of a part does the export market play in your industry?
Recall the port strike of, 2 years ago now. When the ports were shut down here on the West Coast, we lost almost $700 million worth of business. That's how much business we were doing just to the Asian theater. Now, if you're moving over to Australia, if you're moving up into Canada, there's a lot more product potentially to be lost. As a $3.5 to $4 billion industry, you can assume that roughly 25% of that revenue is generated from the export market. So it's a significant concern. The ability to export is important to this industry, and while we strive to satisfy the domestic market, we've also have enough production that those customers overseas are still clamoring for California navel oranges, California lemons, California mandarins. So we are the nation's number one fresh citrus producing state, and there's demand for our product.
Now, when it comes to trade, your group has also been in the news recently regarding another decision made by the Trump administration. They recently approved a plan to open the U.S. market to lemons from Argentina. You were very critical of that move. If free trade is good, why is that deal bad?
The free trade is good, and that one was bad because of the process in which a trade agreement was reached allowing the Argentines access. And by that, I mean they have pest and disease issues. They have a history of having interceptions, particularly in the EU. They have a history of not being transparent. And the rule cited a specific trip that occurred in May of 2015 in which technical experts went to Argentina to explore what the pest and disease pressures were. We never saw that trip report. There's supposed to be total transparency on that. We were never told where they visited and what they saw. There's supposed to be complete transparency on that part. Then they went down for a confirmation trip in September of 2016, and they went down there when there was total dormancy. They couldn't see any farming practices. They couldn't see any packing house practices. They couldn't see what pressures farmers and shippers were undergoing down there as they were moving fruit. So we have a rule that was based upon a trip that which we know nothing about, no studies, no report was made, and confirmed by a visit that occurred when nothing was going on. For us, that doesn't necessarily quantify into a legitimate protocol for exporting lemons into the United States. And that's why we have been fighting this so dramatically. The effort started in roughly 2001, maybe a year before, and we were expressing some serious reservations at that time for the same reason, and we were right. There was a multitude of factors that came about as a result of our efforts to challenge the administration at that time. Last year, there was multitude of interceptions of citrus black spot on fruit into the EU. That's something that doesn't exist in California. It does exist in Florida, and they have to treat significantly for it. That's a blemish on the exterior part of the fruit. We don't need any more problems. That's probably one of two trade agreements that we have opposed dramatically. It's because of pest and disease issues. We were supportive of an effort by the Australians to have access. We were supportive of an effort when the Uruguayans wanted access. We were supportive of an effort when Peru and Chile wanted more access. So the list goes on, and there was a certain part of South Africa that wanted access, and we said, sure, come on in. We don't like competition, but we'll take it on. But when another section of South Africa came in and they had multiple pests and diseases, no, we're not ready to accept that challenge.
How satisfied are you that agriculture has a seat at the table with these negotiations and just all the talk about trade in the Trump administration? Are you satisfied with your seat at the table?
Yes. They have been very transparent to those of us that have a track record, a credible track record on trade. They have been very open to conference calls. They've been very open to meetings when I travel to the United States. Doesn't necessarily we're always in agreement, but there is a professionalism that exists in trying to work out areas of concern that we have or challenges that may be coming from a specific country. So there has not been the leadership at USDA, until just recently. It was a bit late in getting the new team in place. But the mid-level team that exists at USDA and USTR are very familiar with California Citrus Mutual, very familiar with the California citrus issues, and have been very open in their efforts to try to satisfy our concerns. So, yeah, I'm happy. I'm pleased. We just got to work our way through the process.
Joel Nelson of Exeter-based California Citrus Mutual commenting on the renegotiations that are now underway between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada on the North American Free Trade Agreement. Joel, thank you so much.
Joel, thank you for the opportunity.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. In the next part of our program, we'll learn how backers of a proposed new reservoir in Northern California are hoping to get funding from the state to build it, and we'll go whitewater rafting on the Kern River. In the latest edition of our podcast, Outdoorsy, that's all coming up straight ahead on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. More than a dozen water storage projects are vying for money from the Proposition 1 water bond California voters approved in 2014. Sites reservoir supporters are asking for more than half of what's earmarked for storage projects. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, the request comes even though supporters say they have enough investment from water agencies to get it built without taxpayer money.
Mary Wells walks along a dirt road tucked into a deep valley in Colusa County. She owns a cattle ranch here about an hour northwest of Sacramento.
I've Been here 47 years, I believe. Raised my children here, grandchildren, spent a lot of time here. It's been a wonderful home for us.
But the proposed site's reservoir would flood her ranch with 350 feet of water. It would also inundate 14,000 acres of grassland she relies on to feed her cattle.
It's a very bittersweet situation for me. First of all, I don't want to see it disappear. I would just as soon spend the rest of my days here and have my grandchildren take over and carry on. But I do believe it needs to happen.
The reason? Her family farms on the other side of the valley, and she says building sites would mean more water.
If they are to continue with an assured water supply so that they can economically continue to farm and Sacramento Valley stays viable relative to the environment and its agriculture, this reservoir has to happen.
The proposed $5 billion reservoir would be the seventh largest in the state, almost twice the size of Folsom Lake. It would be off-stream, meaning water to fill it would move through canals and pipelines rather than damming the Sacramento River. Fritz Durst is with the site's Reservoir Joint Powers Authority.
In years when we have a lot of rainfall on the west side of the valley here, it can pick up those high flows in the Sacramento River and put that into the reservoir. So this year, if sites would have been dedicated last fall and empty, it would be full right now. So that's 1.8 million acre feet.
That's about enough water to meet the needs of 9 million people a year at capacity. On average, it would capture much less. Enough water agencies have already signed on to purchase the water and build the project. But the JPA wants the state to invest $1.6 billion from Proposition 1 to buy half the water for the benefit of the environment.
Some of the water will stay north of the Delta for use for agriculture, but the other big improvement will be for the ecosystem. They could put more water to wildlife refuges, or perhaps it would go to a certain run of fish another year, or maybe it's Delta smelt.
Durst says sites could provide cold water for spawning salmon and could improve water quality in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. But some environmentalists say the benefits are too few to ask for so much taxpayer money.
They're in the sales phase of this project where they can promise water to everybody and for every purpose.
Ron Stork is with Friends of the River.
This is a reservoir that has been proposed for many, many years. And it hasn't been built because it's not cost-effective.
But Sites has a powerful and wealthy ally, the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. It's put up $1.5 million toward the project already. General Manager Jeff Keitlinger says it likely won't invest more unless California moves forward with building two tunnels under the Delta.
For us, it's tricky to invest in more storage north of the Delta when we don't know can we move it across the Delta.
The California Water Commission will make a decision on which projects get funding from Proposition 1 in June of 2018. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
So when you get in the kayak, I want you to pretend that you're wearing a very tight skirt and you're getting into a sports car. See, every woman here goes, yep, got it.
Hey guys, I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Ezra David Romero. This is Outdoorsy, a podcast from Valley Public Radio.
We take you to wild places in Central California and introduce you to the people who explore them.
So Carrie, this summer I've been on the river a lot, floating, some kayaking, and well, a lot of sunbathing.
I went on a wine cruise last week during my honeymoon in Eureka. Does that count?
No, not quite, but thanks for making me super jealous. Actually, rivers around here have been amazing. They've been really high the past few months because of the record snowfall in the Sierra this winter. That's generally a good thing, but is made for some dangerous conditions.
Yeah, and earlier in the season, local authorities even closed rivers like the Kings and Kern to swimmers and boaters. A number of people in the valley drowned because fast-moving water can be so dangerous.
This caution took a toll on rental industries like whitewater rafting. But now that flows have slowed and the season is looking to be extra long this year, this episode will focus on two sports, whitewater rafting and kayaking.
In this episode, we'll travel deep into the Kern River Valley and learn how to whitewater raft on what's known to be a mean set of rapids.
Plus, we'll go on a group kayaking trip on the San Joaquin River and learn what kind of gear you'll need to take up the sport.
First, whitewater rafting. there are so many options. You can find rafting companies along the Kings, the Kaweah, and the Kern Rivers.
To find out more about this sport, I found a guy who grew up on the water. Meet Matt Volpert. He owns Kern River Outfitters deep in the hills of Kern County.
I love showing people the outdoors. I love seeing that excitement. I also love how there's like not a sense of being out of control, but you know, you got a guide. You're not on a roller coaster by any means. It is exhilarating. It's hard. It's a lot of fun. And people really enjoy it.
It's here near Lake Isabella where Matt and his crews take thousands of adventure junkies on rafting trips on the Kern River. For wild rides, Matt says he takes trips above Lake Isabella and below the dam for a bit tamer trips. The water runs faster and harsher above the lake.
It is close to LA, so you have that big population base. It's a big whitewater river. We've got terrific access, meaning if we want class 5, we can do it in 15 minutes, like drive to it. If you want a class 2, mellow section, we have that as well. If you're looking for a multi-day, we have that, and it's all right here. In other rivers, you might have to drive, you know, hours to get to that access, where here we have it all right in town, or just south of Lake Isabella. And it runs a long time. Because we have Isabella Lake, that is a regulated flow, meaning we can have rafting well into August and in a year like this into September.
This is my first time whitewater rafting, and before we launch out onto the water, Matt and the other river guide on the trip give me the lowdown on what I need to know. Here's river guide Anna DeSanto.
The first thing you need to know about rivers, like the most important thing, is if you are outside of the boat on your own personal whitewater adventure, swimming in the water, you never want your feet to be down. That's rule number one. Never let your feet drop below your body. Always keep them above. Whether you're in swimmer's position, which is when you're floating down the river, looking down the river, keeping your feet in front of you like this, or you're swimming aggressively with your feet kicking behind you.
For that, I kind of like to think of sea otters floating in the ocean with their paws and feet sticking up out of the water.
Yeah, you just keep your feet right straight up, right in front of you, out of the water. After that, she says the most important things to remember while on a rafting trip are to listen for the guide's rowing commands.
What's going to happen is Anna will be front right, you'll be front left, and I will be back left, essentially navigating the boat. In terms of commands, I've got three very basic commands, and then we'll get into more advanced maneuvering as we float downriver. The three commands I have are forward paddle, back paddle, and stop.
The three of us are on a giant gray inflatable raft floating down the Kern River below the dam. We're about to pass through an area called Horseshoe. It's a set of rapids, and yes, it looks treacherous. The sound of the audio got a little jumbled as water splashed the GoPro. Matt is saying row once, and then row twice, over and over again.
Come on.
That was sweet.
Such a fun rapid.
Yeah.
I was love looking back at it.
Matt says beginners always go out with a guide and should test a sport on a couple-hour day trip like this one. On a guided trip, they'll provide all the equipment, life jackets, the boat, helmet, and a lunch. All you have to bring is water, sunglasses, a hat, clothes that can get wet, water shoes or sandals, and sunscreen. His trips range from $160 for a quick trip to about $400 for 2 days. Matt says if you really want to get into the sport, he advises joining a club or finding a friend who has a boat. Later, if you're still really into it, then he advises on buying a raft and gear, which can cost thousands of dollars.
If you're thinking about it, getting into rafting as a private boater, as we call them, you probably want to make sure you love it before you drop that on a boat and then realize you're not really into it. There's raft rental companies out there. This year, to be honest, I don't think very many people were renting boats just because with the high water, they didn't want the risk of their equipment getting ruined or lost. But they're out there. Or on Craigslist, too. You can find stuff occasionally.
So how has the high water affected his business this summer?
Matt says 5 years of drought forced him to close up shop in 2014 and 2015. And this year, after newspapers published articles about the deaths on the Kern River, his business immediately slowed. Matt claims these deaths were caused by people using the river irresponsibly. Still, he says the record rain and snow are a nice reprieve from years of bad weather. He expects the season to go well into September and maybe even into October.
The beautiful snowpack that we had, that is measured to compare to other years in terms of a percentage of the April 1 average. This year we clocked in at 248% of normal. I think we had a year that clocked in 2015 at like 5% of normal. Rafting just didn't happen then. This year we came in on the other scale of that, you know, well over 200%, and that equates to a longer rafting season.
In the 27 years his family's operated on the Kern River, he says there have been zero deaths on their trips. This sort of assured me that we'd live as Matt guides us down one particularly long set of rapids.
Woo! That's awesome. That was sweet.
Okay, Ezra, so that sounds pretty fun, but I admit I'm not all that interested in a thrill ride. I'm more of a kayak girl. Are there many opportunities for that around here?
Yeah, totally. It's a relatively easy sport to get into, because you can rent a kayak at places like Millerton or Shaver Lake for less than $100. My buddies and I often bring our kayaks out to the lake, but rivers work for that too. I found a group that leads trips down the San Joaquin River just outside of Fresno. Sharon Weaver with the San Joaquin River Parkway and Trust says the river here is perfect for beginners.
When the River Parkway Trust first started back in 1988, people realized that the best way to get people excited about protecting the river is to actually get people out on the river so that people can see how beautiful this resource is and just how wonderful it is that we have this resource right in our own backyard. And we wanted to get people out on the river so that they would care about it and want to protect it.
Like the whitewater rafters on the Kern River, the Parkway started their kayak and canoe program late this summer because of record flows due to floodwater releases from Millerton Lake. Weaver was concerned about safety. Now that the river has calmed down, the kayak and canoe program is back up and running. The trips cost $30 to $45, depending on length. Today, river guide Anita Lodge is leading a group of 10 first-timers down the San Joaquin River at a place called Owl's Hollow.
Okay, come on down. Have a seat. Do you want to take that backpack off?
No, it's good. Okay. It just gives me more padding since I'm short.
Okay. Perfect. I'm going to give you a shove. Just paddle on.
No problem.
Anita says the requirements for kayaking are pretty much the same as whitewater rafting. You'll need a kayak, an oar with a paddle on each end, a life jacket, snacks, and water. The more dangerous the kayak trip, the more safety equipment a kayaker will need. A helmet, goggles, elbow pads. She has very few rules about kayaking, just that you always wear your life jacket. Make sure your paddle fully submerges as you row, and if you flip out, keep your feet up.
Okay, so when you're holding your oar, you want this long part to be on the top. And you want it to curve back. I want you to hold your arms so they're about like at a 45 degree angle when you hold it over your head. So when you're paddling, you're going to reach all the way as far out as you can, pulling back and pushing forward at the same time. Using your whole arm, you're going to get a lot of power and a lot of strength.
She says a kayaking trip like this is the perfect starting point for a beginner. I wasn't going to go out today, but they had an extra kayak, so Anita launched me out for a quick turn on the water. She met me out there after giving me her final tip.
It seems like most problem we have in tipping the kayak is when you get in it right here. So when you get in the kayak, I want you to pretend that you're wearing a very tight skirt and you're getting into a sports car. See, every woman here goes, yep, okay, got it. Guys. Bottom goes in first, you sit down, and then you put your feet in there.
That's great. It's such a good visual. I immediately know what to do.
You know what? Not everyone knew what to do, so it took some learning, even for me. You know, on each of these tours, there are two guides and plenty of places to stop and jump into the water. Both Anita and Sharon have been kayaking for years. Sharon says if someone wants to really get into the sport, she suggests a kayak in the $700 range, made specifically for rivers, but also can be used on the lake. Kayaks can be as inexpensive as $100 or as expensive as a couple $1,000s. My old lake kayak cost $200.
For a beginner, it's great to look at these sit-on-top varieties because they're very easy to maneuver, easy to paddle, they're pretty light and easy to carry around. People that are really interested in fishing from a kayak, there are all kinds of kayaks that are pre-set up with fishing gear and fishing rod holders and things like that. So for a basic entry-level kayak like the ones we use for our tour, you might pay $500, $600. It's pretty inexpensive in terms of your equipment cost to get into kayaking. You've got to buy your kayak, your life jacket, your paddle, and you're pretty much good to go.
Sharon says lake kayaks are usually a bit shorter and have a hard time with fast-moving water. One time I brought a short kayak out on the San Joaquin and I kept flipping over in the rapids, whereas my friends in Long River kayaks had no problem at all. For a full kit, kayak, life jacket, and oar, she says expect to spend about $800 to $1,000. Sharon says the kayak and canoe program on the San Joaquin River exists because she wanted to educate people about the river.
We also really want people to understand how to enjoy the river safely. Every year, you know, we have experiences where people get in trouble on the river because they underestimate the force of moving water. And so it's really important to us that we give people good skills so that they understand, you know, what they're getting into when they get out onto moving water, because it is very different when you're in a moving water environment than a still water environment.
She says this nature corridor on the edge of Fresno is a perfect escape from the bustle of city life. Her organization advocates for the river and is working on establishing a 22-mile trail along its banks.
And that's today's show. Check out the website for information about where you can whitewater raft and kayak in the Central Valley.
Share your photos on a river near you on our Instagram or Twitter. We're OutdoorsyPod on both.
Our editor is Jill Moore, and we had engineering help from Don Weaver.
Our music is by Kevin McLeod and Ben Sound.
Stay tuned for future shows when we visit other wild places and interview the people who love them. For Outdoorsy, I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Ezra David Romero. Thanks for listening.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. You can find our Outdoorsy podcast, our Valley Edition podcast, and more on our website at kvpr.org, as well as all of the stories you heard on today's program and other editions of Valley Edition. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, and let us know what you think on Twitter as well, at KVPR and at Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This has been Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.